Yes, I'm sorry you've had to sit through three now, well, will be three talks on gravity waves, and not even the cool kind. Daniel and I were supposed to split this, so, but of course I got sick. So anyway, so I'm going to talk some more about details, to talk to them about them otherwise, and a lot of the complications to do with internal gravity waves and implementing them in stars. Okay. So I'm going to talk a lot about stochastic generation, because that's kind of where Daniel left off. And then I'm going to talk about angular momentum transport, and I'm going to talk about like the complications with these two things. And then possibly I'll get to chemical mixing, but probably not, and I don't have a lot to say about that, because I'm not done with that project. Not that I'm done with any of it, but anyway, some pictures of gravity waves. Let me just start with this nice demonstration of the dispersion relation of gravity waves. This is called the St. Andrew's cross. And so you have this, you know, oscillating bob, whatever it is, and it generates these internal waves that propagate away from it. And this is the simple 2D dispersion relation for internal gravity waves. So this cosine, this angle is the angle between the wave vector and the horizontal. And so if we do a little nice picture of this, the simpler thing to look at is the This has stopped working. Of course it has. The angle between the phase lines, which are perpendicular to the wave vector, and the horizontal. And the reason I'm showing that is because it's very nice, because you can just, like, this is a little, I give this as a test in one of my classes, just give them this picture and tell them to figure out, and I tell them what the Brunt-Weissler frequency is, and I tell them to figure out what frequency the bob is going at. It's just a very simple thing. So the reason I show this is just because I'll show you some simulations in a couple slides, in a lot of slides, right? And you can see very clearly what frequency of waves are being generated just by the angle at which the phase lines come off of the generation site. So that's why I'm showing this, okay? So just so you kind of get an idea.
So in other words, if you were to change the frequency of the bob oscillation, the angles would...
Yes, the angle would change. Yeah, so the angle is just omega over n, effectively. Yeah, or cos inverse. Well, sine inverse if you look at the phase lines, which is the simpler thing to look at. Yeah, because that's what your eye sees.
This pre relation holds up to 3D.
Yes, it's
yeah.
A cone.
I mean, what's that?
In 3D, it's cones rather than
yes.
Crosses.
So that's right. So, but just if you see the phase lines, you can pick out the angle. Yeah. Done. Right. It's very nice. So yeah, so I'm just showing that so you know have some thing to put your head in. And so this is why I'm showing this. This is the trying to play this one, but it's not gonna let me. Okay, so this is an old simulation I did more than a decade ago now of convection. It was kind of supposed to be like a solar type thing, driving waves. You can see that this is temperature, so white is hot and black is cold. And you can see sort of plumes coming down. That's what those white spots down at the bottom there. And they're generating high frequency waves. You can see it. You can see that the angle is pretty high. Yeah? And then if we look at Daniel's picture movie from before, we see fairly low frequency waves. The phase lines are pretty horizontal. Yeah? And, you know, Daniel and I still haven't figured out why these are so different, okay? So we're still, I mean, yeah, I don't really want to venture to guess. These Rayleigh numbers are very similar. This is an anelastic approximation, so that is something, and that might make a difference. This is a Boussinesq calculation. So that could make a difference. The up-down makes no difference. This is Boussinesq, so... So we're still trying to work that out.
Before you leave.
Yep.
On your simulation, early on it looks very much like GANs. This develops a bit later.
Well, I think the early on perturbation, the initial perturbation that gets it going, is just like an m equals 2 or something.
Low frequency.
It could be, but I think these plumes I am going to argue that the plumes generate these higher frequencies later, okay? And I think you can see it.
Yeah. Looking on the left-hand side, it looks like the angles are changing. There's
Yeah, that's right. Well, so
it's because of
what's going on in the group velocity is moving that way, and the phase is moving this way. So the phase of the waves, if we go back to this, this one, the phase, so the group is moving along the phase lines, and the phase, so and the phase moves perpendicular. I mean, the phase speed is perpendicular to that. So the phase speed, once we start seeing them, they start moving up like this because the group speed is moving down. Okay, yeah.
Can I give another possible interpretation of why you get kind of angular things?
Sure.
So another way that you can think about it is that if you start bobbing your thing up and down and just do a couple motions, you can think of it as starting off the oscillation impulsively, and that means that for the first little bit, you have a lot of different waves, in particular high-frequency waves, but then after a while, it shifts to lower frequencies. So you would expect to start at steep angle and then kind of shallow out of it, which I think is maybe consistent.
But that's right, and because I think it's plumes generate high frequencies. That's, I'm going to argue that, because it goes like the intrusion time, and the intrusion time is short. Yeah. So this would be consistent with what I think about how plumes generate waves. Okay. So that's
right,
possible.
Is that a simulation or that's the actual water?
That's simulation. Simulation of the water.
Right. But I think that the water experiment, you also get pretty horizontal things.
Sure.
Well.
What you end up getting is really one giant cell in the water experiment, whereas here you have many, many horizontal wavelengths across the box. And then obviously this makes up, what the left makes higher frequency.
Yeah.
Why that should be the case, I don't know. But
That's true, but I'm not sure that would affect how much that affects the frequencies.
If you were to widen the water experiment, would it maybe break up into smaller scale structures?
Yes, so we've tried doing simulations of that, and it does break up into smaller scale structures, but the spectrum stays pretty similar.
So the gravity waves are still the same.
Mm-hmm. But what's the argument to make you expect the singularity between those two cases? Because one is upflow and the other is...
Actually, this you can turn around and it'd be exactly the same, because it's Boussinesq. You could not. Because that is an anelastic calculation. Everybody know the difference? No. Okay, so Boussinesq assumes that I will get to use the board. Boussinesq assumes.
Can you turn on the light?
Is it this one?
Let it close.
You don't need any validation or verification.
Yeah, we're not going to do that. So, if this is our continuity equation, like our fully compressible continuity equation, this is Boussinesq. An anelastic is this. So, the difference is that anelastic allows you to have very big density stratification, but still filter sound waves, because it says sound waves are not dynamically important. So it filters sound waves that allows you, so this is more appropriate for a star. Yeah? This is more appropriate for water. Okay, so that's why this doesn't matter. We could turn this upside down and it'd be the same, and that would not be. Okay, but this was just to show, sort of put in perspective, like, you can see high-frequency waves being generated there and not here. Okay? And why we care about, and I'm going to talk about why we care about high-frequency and low-frequency and all that stuff in a minute, but I showed this when I gave my talk at the conference, and it's just like, why we care. We care because these things can really affect the rotational evolution of a star and possibly chemical mixing. I know... Jim said he doesn't think it doesn't have an effect on main sequence. I would say I heard you say it in Daniel's talk. I would argue about that. So I think that's probably true for low mass stars, but for high mass stars are still
transport.
Oh, for energy transport. Okay, for angular momentum transport, particularly massive stars, I think this could be really important.
Yeah.
and chemical mixing as well. So that's why we care. And so I'm going to now start from that. So this is a picture that Connie took from Daniel's talk. So over here was this whole prescription started with Lighthill, applied to pressure waves. Lighthill says, don't do this for gravity waves. It was very clear. He said it in a very nasty letter to David Crichton, who was a big shot fluid dynamicist. Anyway, but let's do it anyway because we think it might work in certain circumstances. So he does it. And then here, you can't really see it, says, this is never, in capitals, seen in simulations. And then he goes through some reasons as to why not. Okay? So we're going to start from there. It's never seen in simulations.
Small scale.
Huh?
I'm sorry, which is not seen?
We never. So this spectrum that I will show you in a minute, the spectrum that's derived from this prescription is never seen in simulations. Okay, the actual amount of energy transferred to waves, that's, you know, more or less seen in simulations. That we can agree on. But the spectrum, that is the energy as a function of frequency, is never seen in simulations. And I'm going to argue it's not seen in experiments either. So, okay. So this is where Daniel left off. He derived this. The flux in waves is like the Mach number times the flux in convection. And then this spectrum, and I dropped off all the other stuff because I'm not even going to think about the rest of it because it turns out the frequency is the most important thing. That's that. Spectrum of waves is a steep function of frequency. So that's -6.5, and I just did this little simple plot. If we had a flux, let's say we said it was -1, that this thing was frequency to -1 instead, and we looked at a 10 microhertz wave, we're talking about, what is that? That's 10 to 10, 8, 7, 6, 11 orders of 10 orders of magnitude or so difference, and if we took that as an amplitude of the velocity, so the cube root, we'd say at least 2 orders of magnitude difference at generation, okay? And that's a big difference. If you're generating waves and at 10 microhertz, and I picked 10 microhertz for a reason, I didn't put the units on here, but whatever, 10 microhertz for a reason, because 10 microhertz waves can escape effective radiative damping fairly well. They can propagate very long distance without being dissipated. So they can get to the surface, and that's important. Okay, so this is why this is so important, because damping length goes like frequency to the fourth. And so this whole spectrum is a big deal. And we never, I don't know about Daniel, but I never get to talk about it because astrophysicists don't want to hear about it. They don't care, right? They just want to know what the output, the outcome is. What's it do to my star? How do I have to change my MESA calculation, right? And you say, well, it's not so clear because, you know, it depends very sensitively on this spectrum. And that's probably why Jim yesterday said if we could give him anything, it would be a reliable spectra. So that's why I said, well, what do you think is reliable, right? Okay, so, and then Daniel showed this nice other, this plot as another motivation. So if this A, and that A is that frequency power of the spectra, is -3.5, then we're over here. And if it's -7.5, we're over here, we can't explain anything. Maybe if it's -1, it's over here, and we can explain a lot. Okay, so it matters quite a lot. And yesterday in Jim's talk as well, maybe if we had higher frequency waves generated, they could propagate further, they'd have more energy, blah, blah, blah. Important, yeah? So, never seen in simulations, so I'm going to show you a bunch of simulations where we never see this. And then I'm also going to show you a bunch of experiments that have that are really cool and have a very clear result from the experiments. Okay, and I just literally got these slides from Bruce Sutherland a few days ago. Okay.
So the never seen is referring to particular alpha values, or I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's this steep power of frequency is never seen. Okay. Now never seen. There's like two of us who have done calculations like this, right? Me and Lucy Alphon. And she sees something completely different. She also doesn't have very good frequency resolution, and the waves are highly damped. So I'm not sure how much I trust them, but I'm only going to show you mine because I'm giving the talk. No, seriously, there's only a couple of us that are actually looking at this problem. There are lots of people that have looked at overshoot and convection and all this stuff, but nobody's actually, I mean, very few people have said, let me do a simulation and figure out what the spectrum of waves generated from it is. Okay? There's a lot of experiments, though. That's not entirely true in the atmospheric science community. Okay? So I'll get to that. So I do these simulations, and this is all the stuff. And since we're talking about details, I guess I'll go through the details. It's an anelastic approximation in 2D. I'm actually going to show you spectra from 3D as well. 3D simulations, we have a reference state model that comes from a Cambridge stellar evolution code. That doesn't matter because we can replace it with a Mesa stellar evolution code. Doesn't affect the waves at all. And in the massive stars, and I talked about this before, the convection drives the waves. And if you get higher frequency waves, those waves can propagate very far. And because of decreasing density, the waves can reach an amplitude at which they'll break. And we see this in my—I see this in my simulations, and that's pretty cool. And it does cool things. And I'm going to talk about those cool things, but that's kind of secondary to the spectrum, which I'll get to in a minute. Now, this is the big problem, and this is where I think Jim and Elliot would have a lot of issues. Okay, and maybe Daniel too. We force the convection, because the waves are going to be damped way more than they should be, because I can't use, you know, stellar values of thermal diffusion in my simulations, I force the convection harder so that the waves are generated at a higher amplitude, so that they can, you know, so that the values at the surface are something like what I might expect, okay, because that's, I'm caring about the surface. But I'll say that this is only done in some simulations. And I have a lot of simulations where I don't do that, and it affects the spectrum not at all. Okay? So the spectrum, the amplitudes, yes, but the spectrum, that is the energy as a function of frequency, doesn't change. So this 10 times larger is only for some of the simulations.
When you say the spectrum doesn't change, you mean in relative terms, the relative distribution?
That's right. So the amplitudes, that changes, obviously. But the as a function of frequency, same slope.
Yep.
Same slope. Always. And when I'm going to show you right now that it's not just the same, it's the same slope like always, right? Or very, very close.
Can I just ask, when you say you force the convection harder, so you just literally, I mean, the Brillouin-Weissel frequency is the same?
But the convection, the luminosity is higher, for example. Okay, so the convective velocities are about 10 times, this 10 times larger, again, is only in some simulations. And even in those, again, what I care about is what happens at the surface at some level, right? For some things, some, you know, if I'm talking to Connie, she's like, I want to know what the surface properties are, right? And if I'm thinking about angular momentum transport and what's going to happen at the surface, I care about the surface, right?
But why if I move 10 times faster, the frequencies don't change?
That's right. So why is that? They don't.
The frequencies do change, but the wave frequencies, Tammy says, doesn't change.
That's right.
So I think the convective turnover times do go faster.
That's right. And I'm saying that the wave spectrum does not depend on that. And that's where we have this like big breakdown between like me and Jim and Elliot and everybody else who doesn't listen to me. Daniel.
So I want to point out that when I do simulations and I basically change the strength of convection, I change the convection frequency, I actually do get different waves. And you can see it from the movie where if the convection frequency is higher, then you get higher frequency waves, so which is to say that the angles are...
So if you change convective velocity, it will change the frequencies.
Yes.
We have not seen this in any publication.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so let me... Okay, so Daniel says that this happens, but I'm actually going to show... Well, at least in my simulations, it does it over many orders of magnitude in Rayleigh number, Reynolds number, and then I'm going to show experiments where it doesn't happen. Okay?
Can I ask, so the waves that are being generated are still linear?
So at generation, so what we do is at generation we look and see how much of the energy is in a separable function, i.e. linear waves. And at generation it's usually around 70%. So somewhat linear, somewhat not. At generation, you wouldn't expect it. I mean, at generation, it's like overshoot, all sorts of hell's going on there. So, yeah. And also, in the massive stars, at the top, also not linear. So there's some range where they are, but yeah. Anything else? Okay, so this is a movie or a simulation I showed during conference, and I'll show a movie of it later again. And this is kind of the spectrum we see. So we plot energy, not flux, okay, because flux is a weird thing that theorists come up with, right? Because it's actually energy times the group velocity. Well, group velocity, picking it out in the simulation, well, it's something like a velocity, so let's just forget it. We'll say energy. And we look at that at generation. So this is just, this is half a pressure scale height outside the convection zone, okay? And then we say, how much is in the separable form? And then of that amount that's in a separable form, we do best fits. And here's the frequency, you can't read it, frequency, and this is the energy, it's a function of frequency, and it's minus 0.9. And then out here, at very high frequencies, it starts to fall off. Okay? So, and wave number, let's not worry about that for now. I'm going to care about the frequencies.
So, now Tammy, the theoretical prediction is that at a fixed wave number,
yeah,
that the frequency dependence at high frequencies, yep, go like frequency to some steep power.
Yeah, I understand. So we don't do that for these because I don't think it's the appropriate thing to do, but I'll show you in a minute. I have in my,
right,
in my, you know, what I consider less sophisticated fits to all this. We do that, and it's still like, because this is actually, if you were to do the simplest possible thing in flux, this is a flat. This is flat flux. This isn't minus one. This is flat flux. Because it goes like energy times the group speed, which is like omega over k. Yeah?
Okay, so you're getting flat and then minus
flux,
3.
Flux, and then minus 3.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's actually the exact same thing that I have in the water simulation.
Yes, I know. And that's why I say we don't, that's why I don't understand why you say we disagree. We don't, because we get flat and then, yeah.
But that's integrated over k.
Integrated over k.
Yeah.
So you said something changes when you change.
That's right. So basically, where you go from being
break,
flat to
break,
where this break happens.
So your break doesn't.
The break it does change, but it doesn't change more than it changes in time in a simulation. So I've taken simulations and I've said, let's see how much this thing changes in time, because you know this is a time dependent process, right? And this changes a little bit, and I'm going to talk about why I think that is in a minute, okay? Yeah.
I think it's worth noting that the wave number spectrum does peak at the lowest wave numbers.
Yes, yes, it does. Always.
Yeah.
Always.
At least for this core.
So that's good for you.
Yeah,
yeah, I know.
It's nice for waves getting yeah, long distances because the high L waves tend to damp.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so we'll not look at the movie now. It'll put everybody in the epileptic fit. So you can't really see this very well. It's a lot of words. And this is a lot of different, this is different simulations as a function of, this is rotation rate. Okay? And all you need to know is there's zero, that's minus 1.2, and then minus one, I don't even know what that says, minus 0.7, minus 0.5, and then here, at our fastest frequency, we start to see buildup at the rotation frequency, which is what we expect. Okay, so we start to see this buildup of inertial waves there, and then that's steeper. So actually, so you can see that the position of the breakpoint does change with rotation. It also, like I said, changes a little bit. We also, in these, like, here's what I say, where I say what depends on. This shallow spectrum, and by shallow, I mean like flat and then this part, because this, in my simulations, goes out to 20 to 80 microhertz, which by many people's standards would say that's high frequencies. If you're Jim and you think turnover frequency is like 1 microhertz, right? So you think 20 is high, 10 is high, okay? But these are all going out to like 20 to 50. This shallow spectrum seen over 2 to 3 orders of magnitude in Rayleigh number, more than an order of magnitude in Reynolds number, 2 orders of magnitude in rotation rate, and the only time we see very steep frequency spectrum is when we run really low Rayleigh numbers, when it's diffusion dominated. Okay, so this kind of thing is, I've seen a lot, and you say, okay, well, It's those simulations. Well, maybe. Well, I'm going to argue why. Okay, so if we looked at the movie, these are just like snapshots from the cylinder movies that I've made boxes. And we see, like, this is, and in the movie you can see plumes come in. You see this plume, you see wave phase lines, those are high frequencies. It's very clear. And here we don't see any real big plumes, and we see low frequencies. Okay? And the theory does not account for plumes. Full stop. And I think a lot of us in fluid dynamics really know that plumes are important, especially in generating internal waves. So for the theory to not really account for those, I think that's where the theory is lacking. And I think that might be why we see this distinction. Okay, because the plumes directly force...
I don't quite understand what these two different... I mean, these are idealizations.
No, these are just like two different time snapshots in my simulation.
Okay, so there's intermittency.
This is one where, yeah, of course. There's intermittency. These plumes are like, bang, oh, no plume for a while. Bang, another plume. No, no, no.
Okay.
You know, and maybe I should have shown, I'll show the movie. Maybe I should show the movie.
Before you show the movie, I think I'll ask a very stupid question. For me, plums and A's were kind of interchangeable.
Daniel kept doing that. I don't think they're interchangeable at all.
But what is it?
A plume is like one, like, for example, some thin or relatively thin thing, intruding, okay? So, there's one that went off. So it sort of, it doesn't have to span the whole convection zone, but often they do. They span the whole convection zone and they intrude on the adjacent layer. Okay, so then you can see, like, I think in the other box movie I showed, you could see like little white dots at the bottom. That was a hot bit of air that was downflowing, like a downflow lane, and then it intrudes on the overlying layer. So it's a coherent thin structure generally.
So Eddie is
like this.
So would you say this is like an intermittency effect that has to do with the tail?
It could, yeah. Well, I think it's a plume effect, which could, you know, you could say plumes come from intermittency. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So if you see this...
So there's the movie.
Do you see this kind of distinction in, like, you know, atmospheric phenomena and stuff?
Yeah.
You do. Okay, well, I'm going to get to that.
Well, I'm not going to talk a lot about atmospheric phenomena. I'm going to talk about a lot of experiments to do with atmospheric phenomena. So this is the eddy picture, and this is the plume picture.
So plume is going up when eddy is...
going around.
No, I mean, it's just like, if you speak both about the simulations, but mixing with theory,
yeah.
Okay, it's interchangeable, right? I mean, what goes up, goes down.
Yeah.
And it's how it's derived.
mixing length theory is a different thing, right? I mean, yeah.
No,
but
I understand. But it's just
it's how heat is transferred, yeah. And I would say in turbulent convection simulations, and I think in experiments and, you know, other phenomena, we see plumes, and maybe we see eddies too. I don't know. Yeah. So I think the fact is we all know that these things kind of coexist. And if you look at this simulation, you can see the plume intruding, and then it like breaks up, and then all these little eddies come off of it. So eddies are like the little whirls, and the plumes are like long structures.
And when you're not getting a plume, you're getting something that doesn't really push into the...
That's right.
Intrude.
It doesn't intrude in the same at the same level. It sort of stresses the boundary.
Relifts it.
Yeah, so I think of a plume as kind of being larger scale.
Oh, I don't think so. No.
Small length scale.
The plume.
Large length in terms of the length of the convection zone, small in terms of its intrusion size.
Right, yeah.
I mean, we all know that mixed length theory doesn't work very well, but I mean, if you think of that on those terms, if you compare those two things, which are equivalent to what we consider as element of a mixing length.
Yeah, I think that's the plume. And then
the
eddy is a small scale structure driven by the plume. Is that consistent with your...
I don't like to think of mixing length theory in terms of, I don't know. Because usually you think about a plume, in mixing length theory, you think about a plume that rises some distance and then shares its energy or whatever, right? That, you know, then I think, or an eddy that, so I don't know how to think about mixing length theory in this picture. But I will say that turbulence has both.
Oh, funny. We're very linearly focused, right? So we try to think in terms of these coherent structures that move around.
Yeah.
And this even the eddy picture is kind of just an approximation.
It's very basic. It's a very basic picture of turbulence. That's right. Turbulence is very intermittent. It has plumes. Sometimes that span the whole, even if you have very big convection zones, that span the whole convection zone. And neglecting those in any treatment of waves, I think, is a big mistake.
Well, what I mean, though, is that even if there were no plumes and we're just trying to explain turbulence in terms of eddies.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The eddies themselves are not coherent structures that last long periods of time.
Yeah.
And, there's no sort of eigenvalue analysis, eigenfunction analysis that you can do that just pulls out the amplitudes of all the eddies.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Okay. So we get this kind of spectrum that I mean a relatively flat at over a fair range of frequencies for a lot of simulations. So this is the highest frequency one. It gets steeper, but then you get a buildup at the rotation frequency. So, but either way, this is still minus 1.2, right? So we're getting nowhere near what would be like this in the theory, okay? And I think this is because the plumes are directing high frequency waves. And if we look at this spectra and we try and understand this breakpoint, you can do just a simple little analysis, which I do, which is I say the penetration depth of the plume is like the vertical wavelength of the plume it generates, of the wave it generates. And then we can just say, well, what's the maximum horizontal length scale of a wave that's generated by a plume? And it's like 1 over the penetration length. And that's assuming a very high frequency wave. That's assuming omega over n is 1. That's the maximum. The maximum it could do. And it turns out that in those simulations where the breakpoint is very consistent with the plume penetration, with the plume penetration depth. And of course, that varies. The plume penetration in any given time, in any given plume, varies a little bit. And then the frequencies, so this is just like my heuristic little argument as to what's happening, where things are generating what. So if you look at the plume frequency and you say, well, we're going to take a plume velocity divided by a plume, the penetration depth, we can get plumes generating frequencies up to 250 microhertz. That's pretty high, directly generating. And again, the plume velocity varies, and this varies. All these things vary. Sadly, it's not this nice picture that's the same all the time. And then if we did something for the eddies, we get a convective turnover time, which is less than the plume velocity generally. And we take the size of an eddy, and generally the eddies in our calculation are not the size of the convection zone, but are actually smaller. And then we say we get only eddies only generating less than 5 microhertz. So if you just do this simple analysis, you can see that plumes can generate high frequency waves. And this has been, so Montalban and Schaffner in 2000, they tried to do a plume sort of theory like Daniel did, and they get something like exponent to the minus frequency squared is their dependence, and they use a plume model from Riotort and Zahn. So, and when they do that, they actually can explain some lithium problem, I can't remember. But you should look at these papers for how this could be implemented.
So at the bottom, you're saying the penetration depths are actually smaller than plumes? I'm looking at the comment at the bottom right. Penetration depths are smaller than eddies?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the eddies are smaller than the whole convection zone, but the plume penetration depth varies, but it's generally smaller than the eddy size.
Not smaller than the eddy penetration.
Okay, sorry. Okay? So this is just, it's very hard in a simulation I tried for a long time to figure out exactly what convective structure is causing what waves. And this is an impossibility. If anybody has any ideas about how to do this, please let me know, because it's just not, it's really difficult. And I tried doing, I can't remember what it's called, but you know, the Fourier spectrum as a function of time, basically, phase, I don't know, anyway, those things, and you just can't, you can't isolate structures and then say those are clearly generating waves. It's just really hard. So I really am only left to this resort, or somebody who wants to do some math and try and combine Daniel slash that theory, which again, I don't think is appropriate, but let's say you want to do a theory, let's combine that with some plume theory.
At each point in time, how many, this plume penetration depth, how many plumes is that derived from? Are you averaging over lots of plumes, or is this one plume?
No, I just took an approximate, general. I just took a general value. So because I want to just get that, so what I want to do is say, is it even remotely consistent with this length scale?
But I mean, so is the variation in position, because you're drawing from a distribution of plume penetration depth with a finite number of plumes at any time, or because the actual distribution of plume penetration depth is changing as time goes on?
Okay, so the plume penetration depth changes in time, can change in time, but I wouldn't say it's like a monotonic one way or the other. It just changes. One plume might have a slightly higher velocity than another, and then be able to penetrate slightly more.
Okay, some distribution function of penetration depth.
Yeah.
And the question is, are you drawing stochastically from that at each point in time, and therefore you're seeing this move around? Or are you actually seeing...
No, because when you see this thing is done obviously over a fair amount of time. Right? This isn't wave number, but we take the spectra over a long period of time. And but this changes, like if I take that big chunk of time and then take another big chunk of time later, then this can change a little bit. And it does, and what's interesting is it does change with rotation, which you actually expect, because you expect as rotation happens, the plumes get diverted from vertical and they don't penetrate as far. So then the length scale changes, and we see that.
I mean, could you make some headway on this problem by doing simulations where you just looked at the, like the Bob experiment, where you took shapes and used them to drive waves?
You, individual shapes, you said.
Yeah. Like create a sort of Gaussian or something like that. And
so something that I've tried is where you just have a plume. Instead of having convection, you just have a plume. Mm-hmm.
But that's very hard, because the plume then generates eddies that flow laterally, right?
Yeah.
So it's very hard to distinguish these things. And if you say, oh, we're just going to make an incursion, like the bobbing eddy, well, that's not anywhere like what we have. So what you could do possibly, I think, is say, let's have a bob with a time scale, and then a random other time scale bob, and that I think you possibly could do. And maybe make some headway and look at how that spectrum that comes from the superposition of all those things gives you what that gives you, because I think that we are missing that. But again, what convection or turbulence does is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of your arguments about what kind of wave spectrum should be generated are based on an intuitive notion of a driver.
Yeah.
With a characteristic length scale.
Yeah.
And of course, in the Fourier spectrum, you know, those eigenfunctions are all, you know, they're not compact.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, it's just a mismatch in the two descriptions.
I agree, but I have to make that simple heuristic description, because then really nobody listens, right? So nobody listens anyway, but at least then I can have some, you know, like, at least we have to make some intuitive sense of what, at least what's going on, right? And it's not just, oh, well, we just pull these things out. We can see it. I mean, our eye is very good at picking out things, yeah? So anyway, but maybe we can make progress that way. And if you say, oh, well, but it must be 2D. Well, no. Because there's a 3D simulation. And this, Daniel, we take L equals a given wave number, a given M. And that, I put the frequencies on there. Why did it not save? That top one is minus 1. This is minus 1.5. OK, and these are different M's. and that's minus 1.5. Okay, and that's like the simple, that's the, you know, crude way to do it. Just take energy as functional frequency and look at it, yeah? Now, that might be why I'm not seeing the double spectrum or the, you know, the double power law, because I haven't done the SVD and all that sort of thing, I don't know. But we, you know, we still see flat.
You're measuring this right at the interface, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And you say, oh, well, maybe it's top versus bottom. No. This is sun simulation. It's a bit steeper, but again, it's nowhere near where the theory is. Okay, so, you know, we can't like go to as turbulent as the sun or whatever star you care about, and we can't do all the parameters right, but we can do a lot. And we can't do a lot in 3D, so Jim, you're never, I think, it's going to be a long time off before you get a parameter sweep in 3D, right? So we can do a parameter sweep in 2D and then say, well, does it compare at all to 3D? And the other thing is, of course, geometry. Well, turns out that in this curved geometry, at least, these are cylinders and that other one is a sphere. Again, it doesn't really matter in terms of frequency. So I would say, what's generating the waves? It's not this eddy picture. Now I'm going to show you some experiments. So this is the synopsis. There's converging evidence from experiments and some simulations of atmospheric kind of things that turbulence drives, and this is turbulence, isn't convection, but just turbulence in general, drives waves that have a peak frequency in a narrow range corresponding to phase lines tilted 30 to 50 degrees from the vertical. Okay, remember, okay, phase lines, tilted, sine, cosine, whatever it is, it's 30 to 50 degrees, it's a big fraction of n, okay, that's high frequencies. And you see, here's some of the papers, and they're all in JFM or physics of fluids, which is why we can ignore them. This is freaking me out right here. This thing. Some authors have suggested that this range optimizes vertical transport of horizontal momentum and suggest a nonlinear action between the waves and the convection to optimize angular momentum transport. Seriously. They're like, why should we continuously get this? I'm going to show you evidence, like all over the map that they get this. And it's like, and they don't know why. Why, no matter what they do, no matter how they drive the turbulence, it comes out like this. And they're thinking, well, this optimizes vertical transport horizontal momentum. If that's true, oh my God, like my whole world is doomed. Anyway, it's really a bit scary to think that that might be the case, but it would be also cool if that were the case. So here's the first evidence. This is from Paul Linden. If you know anything about the fluid dynamics community, you sort of know that the big names, and this is one of them, in experimental fluid dynamics, and you know that damped is Mecca, right? So this is done a long time ago. Paul was then, again, after this, was at San Diego for a long time, just moved back. But here's the sentence. Although it was impossible to determine the distribution of energy in an internal wave field, an impression was obtained that the major contribution occurred at the higher wave frequencies observed, as a dominant pattern appeared to be phase lines propagating at an angle of 35 degrees to the horizontal. That's the first evidence of it. Here's some simulations from Bruce Sutherland. So they've got, experiments. They've got like the moving mesh that drives turbulence. It generates these waves. And there's the angle, 40 to 55 degrees to the vertical. And I'm not saying a lot about these because I don't know a lot about these experiments, but this is just like converging evidence, okay? This is another group, Taylor and Sarkar. You've got boundary layer turbulence. Totally different kind of turbulence, right? I mean, it's driven differently is what I mean. Length scales are different. Everything's different, up instead of down, and dominant outer layer waves have a group directed 30 group velocity 35 to 60 degrees from the vertical axes. You can see it.
So I want to point out that in this paper they actually talk about both the high and low frequency waves.
Yep, but they are generating high frequency. Your theory doesn't generate any high frequency waves. Let's be clear about this, right? And these are clearly efficiently generating high frequency waves. Okay, and then it's consistent with previous lab studies. Okay, lot, because there are a lot. Here's these two are actually simulations of turbulence generated by Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. There's your angle, 45 degrees. This is another shear instability. I think this is also a simulation, 49 degrees. This is turbulence driven from flow across a boundary. There you see the turbulence. There you see the waves. Okay? And then this is the one Daniel showed. And this was, I mean, he sent me this a long time ago. So this is an old version. I don't know. All I know is I see fairly high frequency waves. You can see some low frequency ones as well, but there's some high frequencies. And these were the slopes that he gave. But again, this is integrated. So let's just get to it. It's very hard to compare these experiments to what this theory is. Again, the flux is a weird thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and just to expand on this a bit, we discussed this in our fluid dynamics research paper, that in the experiments at early times, they actually get really strong plumes and they get high frequency waves. So I think this is maybe consistent with with your idea.
Okay.
But then when they wait a bit, they reach a thermal equilibrium, and then the plumes are weaker.
Okay.
And then you get the same low frequency waves that we see in the experiment.
Okay.
And, or in the simulations rather. So kind of at late times, the simulation that Tammy showed of mine is consistent with what they're getting in that experiment.
But this is interesting because I don't even see plumes here. Right? I don't see plumes here. I don't see plumes there. I don't see it in a lot, but you know, I don't know. Either way, we also have to assume that there are plumes going on in convection in stars. But you know, even without them, a lot of these experiments are seeing these high angles.
Yeah, but if you look at my simulations, there's also plumes, right? For those plumes are not generating high
frequency. Yeah.
So
you need hard plumes then, is what you're saying. But I'm saying they don't in these experiments, right? Because you don't see. I mean, you don't see them. But
what's the difference? Why do you get plumes in one case and not another?
So
he gets plumes. He just doesn't get very, very aggressive plumes.
Yeah, so I would say that it all just has to do with the time scale of your forcing. So if you have weaker plumes, I mean, so we still have plumes, but if they're weaker, they're slower, they generate low frequency waves. If they're much faster, then they generate high frequency waves.
Time scale compared to what?
To the buoyancy frequency, like the stable region. Yeah. So that's always the time scale that you're comparing everything.
Right, so it's hard to compare these experiments, especially to the theory, which has a flux, and these are just giving you integrated, yeah.
So, the reason we like to say things in terms of flux and theory is that once the waves are generated, they're not damped, it's their energy flux that's conserved. So that's why we want to know the flux spectrum and not just the energy spectrum.
Okay.
They're just related to power of omega.
Okay,
so
yeah.
That's why
we use flux. Okay, that's why you use flux. Great. Okay, but in an experiment or in a simulation, it's a little bit hard thing to measure.
Yeah.
So it's going to be always a little bit weird trying to compare them. But so certainly from experiments, it's hard to compare these things. Like Daniel said, they're integrated over a wave number. You can't just pick out a wave number in an experiment, right? It's just, you can't do it. So like, so this is hard, but it's very clear from all of these experiments, that they are efficiently generating high frequency waves. I think there's no dissent about this, and they don't know why that they're always and it's always like a particular angle. It's like between 30 and 50 degrees angle. That's as a function of n. Now, how we compare that to stars, I don't know. So, but I will say what's remarkable.
Can I say something? A possible explanation for why you get that angle.
Uh-huh.
So this is some analysis that Mikhail Lebowski did. The experiment in the previous slide did. He showed that if you have a flat excitation spectrum, so if you excite waves uniformly in frequency, then once you put in damping, the waves that get damped the least are the ones at about 30 to 45 degrees. And in all these water experiments, damping is a really important factor because the viscosity of water is actually important for these sorts of things.
So yeah, it could be, well, this is also at sort of, this is goes back to the somehow interaction of driving the waves that transport vertical momentum, yeah? Because the damping is affecting what's left, yeah?
So I would say this is just the linear So this is just from linear theory. It's the omega to the fourth power thing. So that omega to the fourth damping length, that's under the assumption that you're a low frequency wave. That's no longer true at high frequencies, right? So the damping length, as you go to high frequencies, damping length is getting larger and larger. At some point, it actually turns over. And the point at which it turns over is that frequency of between
the range at n.
What is it, like 0.4?
Can you write a paper on this? Because those guys don't know about it, all the experimentalists, right?
Yeah.
So, or maybe they know about it, and for whatever reason, But, okay. Either way, they're generating, somehow high-frequency waves are being generated efficiently in a variety of experimental circumstances. And I think what's remarkable is that it's kind of every scenario they come up with. This isn't, and you would expect, if you looked at the simple theory, you would expect to change depending on the driving, yeah?
So it doesn't vary with Reynolds number?
Well, they're all turbulent, they're all turbulent. If it's boundary layer turbulence versus Kelvin-Helmholtz turbulence versus, stratified, it's all this angle.
So I would actually say that this, I think, would be completely explained by the theory if you assume that in all the cases that they're forcing the experiment at high frequencies.
Okay, fine.
So in that case, you're going to...
Okay, that's fine, but it's turbulence, and they're forcing it at high frequencies, and in stars, it's hard to think that they might be different.
So I think this is what's interesting about the experiments that Miguel did in water and around 4 degrees and the simulations that we were doing, because there you could actually very carefully make sure that your forcing frequency is much less than the buoyancy frequency, and that's why you get these flats.
Yeah, actually, so there's Bruce wrote a paper on this. Actually, depending on what the forcing frequency is as a function of n, what frequencies you get, but you still don't get the lowest. It's a lower, yeah. So
yeah, that's right, yeah.
So there is, anyway, I think that this is strong evidence that high frequencies are generated. Okay, and maybe you can make an argument as to why stars should be different. I'd like to hear it. But so how do these apply to stars? Now, one thing about these experiments that is very different from stars is that they all kind of have a constant n. Yeah, so they have their turbulence, however they're driving it, and then there's a constant Brunt-Weissler frequency, which is not the case in stars, right? At the interface, n varies quite a lot, and even out, it just continuously varies at some level, right? And that may play a role. If you took some superposition of this angle, this frequency as a function of n, and then integrated it over the variation in n, it's very possible that you don't get this narrow thing, that you get some convolution of that. On the other hand, it's still the case that that high frequencies can be generated. So, anyway, so now that we've talked about the complications to do with the spectra, yeah, Jim.
So have you made a plot of n in your simulations of the effect of Brunt in your simulation? What is that?
No, I haven't. You mean like what the peak of the spectrum is as a function of height?
Just what the Brunt-Weissler frequency profile looks like.
Oh, well, it looks like whatever it is from the MESA calculation. I don't remember exactly what
change.
It is.
It doesn't change.
No. It doesn't, the two models that I've done for the three solar mass case, I did one that was from this Cambridge STARRS one. It didn't have the peak, and the other one did, and again, the spectrum doesn't really change that much. So I think there is some kind of, combination of all these different ends and what the waves are feeling and where we take the spectrum matters at some level. Okay. So now I want to talk about the complications of angular momentum transport by waves. Forget the spectra. I mean, the spectra is a complicated thing, and all this will depend on the spectra. But I want to talk about a few other complications. So this is a picture Daniel showed you of the quasi-biennial oscillation. This is an oscillation of the mean zonal winds in the equatorial stratosphere of the Earth. This is over time. The color is the mean wind, okay? And what you can see is that the winds oscillate every 28-ish months. That's called the quasi-biennial oscillation. And it's driven by the interaction of vertically propagating waves. So if you have like clouds generating waves or wind over mountains, they generate these waves. The wave period is generally less than 3 days, and yet they're driving this mean flow oscillation of 28 months. Okay? So this is a nonlinear interaction of waves that drive this flow. And this has been known about forever. And this is my favorite thing ever. Is it playing? Right. So this is called the Plum and McEwen experiment, and this is actually a video of their original experiment in 1978 or 77, where, so let me just tell you what's happening. You have this tank of water, salty water, and you pummel it. You have a membrane at the bottom, and you pummel it with a plus M equals 4 and a minus M equals 4, so prograde and retrograde wave. There's no rotation other than the Earth's rotation where it's sitting, but the thing is not rotating itself, okay? And it's going to take a while, but this remains sort of one of the best laboratory analogs of a geophysical flow that there is, and this is why I love it so much. So it tells you all the properties. Here you go. So if you look sort of at the mean flow, it's kind of going that way down there. And if we watch for a while, we will see it reverse. And we see that it sort of will propagate down as well. So there we see this is going that way. And down below it's kind of going the other way, although it's a little hard to see what's going on down below.
Tammy, presumably the Earth's rotation is totally unimportant in this experiment.
Yes, yeah, I think so. But people have argued with me about whether this thing was rotating before. And I just wanted to say it's not rotating. There is just an instability in a prograde and retrograde wave. It's not a stable thing. So you don't need rotation to break any symmetry for this thing to happen. Yeah, so it will flip, and you can see that it came down, so the source of the waves is down here, and the mean flow sort of comes down, and will eventually, there it goes, so up there it's down the other way, yep. Everybody seen it flip?
Yep.
Right, okay, so this is super cool, right, and this was done a very long time ago to explain the QBO. So I want to go through this because I never get to go through this, and it's really important, and it really matters for, for how we treat waves on our stellar evolution codes, okay? So let's go through how waves drive this shear flow, okay? Because that's something right there. Waves drive a shear flow, i.e. don't use viscosity or diffusion to mimic the angular momentum transport of waves. It doesn't work, okay? So here it goes. Okay, so in a rotating fluid, and it doesn't have to be rotating because initially, if you had prograde retrograde waves, it's an unstable equilibrium, but it doesn't matter for now. Your frequencies of waves goes, the waves are Doppler shifted in the rotating frame, okay? So if there's a prograde and retrograde wave, and their frequencies are shifted with respect to each other, then the prograde and retrograde waves have different frequencies. Okay, so if we look at this picture here, this is adapted from Plum in 1984. We had a prograde wave and a retrograde wave, and it's moving into this shear flow. This prograde wave is moving into an increasing flow, so its frequency is Doppler shifted to lower frequencies. And the retrograde wave is Doppler shifted to higher frequencies. Okay, and then now the second thing that comes in is that the damping length is frequency to the fourth dependent. Okay, so that means that this lower frequency wave is going to dissipate sooner, i.e. in depth, than this retrograde wave. And then the final thing is that prograde waves carry positive angular momentum, and retrograde waves carry negative angular momentum. So this thing, when it damps, it speeds up this region. And that thing slows it down. Okay, so in this way, they sort of cause a shear. And this continues to happen until the shear is so strong that viscosity breaks it down. And then it can reverse, and then the reverse happens. And you get a shear the other way. And then back and forth, back and forth. Okay? So, is that clear? Any questions about that? It's a little complicated process, right? And it depends on these three things, that the waves are Doppler shifted in a differential rotation. And again, even if there wasn't initial differential rotation, one of the waves would dissipate, and then you got differential rotation. And now you got to propagate into that. So, and then there's a damping dependence. This isn't This isn't the case in all kinds of damping, but there is always a frequency dependence. And so then you get shear, and you get shears that oscillate in time. Okay, cute. All right, so waves drive shear flows. Therefore, it's highly suspect, I mean, it doesn't work, to treat angular momentum transport by waves as a diffusion coefficient. It might be okay for chemical mixing. That's a different thing, because it doesn't have a sign. Okay?
So what's the time scale of dissociation?
Yeah, it depends on the forcing. So if you were to write F is like, the forcing is like U prime W prime, which is the fluctuation in the horizontal velocity and vertical velocities, then it would depend on this forcing, okay? But in the QBO and in anything that we might consider, we don't really know what that forcing is going to be in time yet.
So in ONS and Paris, there's a group that's working on redoing these experiments. It turns out that if you just use the parameters that they say in the paper, it doesn't work. Or if you fluctuate it by like 10% in any direction, it doesn't work. So it's very, very finely tuned. But they were able to finally get it working in a broad context, and then they've been trying to change that forcing and change the type of wave that they're exciting and figure out how that influences both the amplitude and the period of the oscillation. So that's kind of current.
So the answer is we don't really know exactly how that works.
But people
have redone the Plum McEwen experiment many times. So I'm surprised to hear that this one didn't work.
Yes, yeah, so in this case they had a lot of experiments.
Anyway, okay. yeah, there's a Japanese group that's redone it several times. And it's been redone in simulations.
Can I just clarify that? So the analogy here is that this experiment, you have forcing at a frequency, but it takes many, many, many frequency cycles for this reversal to occur.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the case of the biennial oscillation, mm-hmm. you have 3-day driving.
Wait, stop there. It's about 3 days. There's a spectrum of waves, and it's not just gravity waves. There are Rossby waves as well, and it's influenced by rotation. This is why it only happens at the equator. So, okay, go on. Okay. Caveat.
The waves that are forcing it are of order days.
Yeah.
And yet you get year
yeah.
cycles. So that's kind of like 700 or
yeah.
something like that, right? Ratio of the order hundreds.
Yeah.
And so this idea that what we're seeing here is something that's happening. It's compressed down to roughly a ratio of hundreds between the forcing and the
in that curve. Case, in that specific case. But I would say in other cases, it really will depend on a lot of things, like how the waves dissipate, like and how what's going on with the viscosity to cause the layer to break down. And this is really important. Like they found some differences in the way the reversal actually happens to what they initially thought. So yeah, but that's
another interesting thing is that biennial is almost 2 years. Of course, the major driver of anything that's going on Earth normally would be the heating that's associated with the annual cycle. But maybe at the equator, the point is that is not as big an effect because the equator feels relatively little forcing from year to year. So that allows this kind of other kinds of physics to basically take hold. It's not just at the equator. At the equator, you have the rotation effects are the strongest, which gives you the Rossby waves, but also that the
weakest.
Weakest. Okay.
So I mean, yeah, I don't actually. They don't fully understand why the QBO is exactly the way it is yet. And this thing we've known about for a long time, and a lot of smart people have been working on it, so I don't really want to go into like how that works, as I don't know. But like, for example, the retrograde flows are stronger than the prograde flows. Anyway, so there's all sorts of details about that still remain to be left done. Yeah.
And also, just over the past year, it seems like the QBO has kind of died off.
They actually use the QBO to like benchmark global circulation models because it's like the thing that actually is very hard for them to get right, and they make sure that they all get it right, because that's a test, okay? So anyway, it's complicated. So when we think about now waves and stars, you've got all the context you need to know that it's complicated, okay? The waves affect the mean flow, which affects the waves. Oh my God, this is a highly nonlinear problem, which depends on the spectrum. Oh my God, and we know that's a mess. And the rotational state, oh, what do we do, okay? So it's, what do we do? How do we proceed? And there's a few different things you've heard about here. So the top one, instead of solving the full set of hydro equations, you just solve the zonal mean, zonal equation, which is that. And we get some estimate from U prime, W prime, from either models like Talon et al. Did for the sun. So you use a model for the spectrum of waves, and you use a model for what the amplitude should be and how the damping goes, and you put it in this equation, and you solve it for long periods of time. Or if you're Jackie and Rich, sorry, Jacqueline, I'm sorry about that, for heat-driven modes, you sort of know what those amplitudes should be from observations. You put them in. You know what the eigenfunction is, so you know how they fall off, and you somehow try to include the back reaction. This is why I was like, Rich, why are you not including the back reaction? Now you know where that question came from and why I thought it was important. If you're Jim, you say, I don't care about the sign. I'm not going to even worry about that, right? I'm just going to say how much momentum is there. And I'm going to put it in one wave number or something. Or even if I am, I'm just going to use the model for the wave number frequency spectra, and I'm going to get some angular momentum, and I'm going to see, can that amount of angular momentum have an effect? Okay, is that a fair representation kind of of your take on the things?
That's what I've done.
Yeah. Okay.
A couple times.
Okay. So this is a very legitimate approach, right? I mean, these things are complicated, so we just want to get a first handle on what they can do, right? So we're going to make approximations. And if you're me, you just say, oh, fuck it. I'm just going to do like brute force, solve the equations on shorter time scales, and see if anything robust comes out. Okay? And that's what I've done. So I think these are all very complementary procedures. Yeah?
Yeah, it'd be great. I just want to comment. It'd be great if we could do this top thing. I think a big question is, what viscosity do you put in?
Yes, that's right. That's absolutely right.
Earth, atmosphere, length scales, just normal viscosity maybe is the most important viscosity, I'm not sure. But in a star, microscopic viscosity is not going to do anything. So what's the right viscosity? That itself is a complicated question.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I also think that even if we knew that and we put this in, right, then the time scale of whatever oscillation is there, right, we might have to resolve that. I don't know how we average over that. You see what I mean?
Right.
Especially given that, like, for example, the QBO has different amplitudes in the two, in the prograde and retrograde flows. And so how we average over that in time, I don't know, right? And I really wish that Georges was here, because I have no idea, and I've asked many people in that group how they did this in this calculation. And they don't, well, the people I've asked don't know, and I certainly don't know. But they did. They said they did it somehow.
So in the top form, where is the frequency of the driving coming? Is it just in the velocity amplitudes?
Yeah, we don't care about that. So again, this is a correlation, right? So it depends on the correlation of those two things. And so when I said those two things are highly when I said that, the experiments are saying, well, maybe we're optimizing vertical transport of horizontal momentum, it's because that angle, 45 degrees, gives you a high correlation there. We don't really consider, like, Rich and Jacqueline, they don't consider that. They just say we have amplitudes, right? And they're, I guess, perfectly correlated. Yeah?
What do you mean by perfectly?
Well, you don't consider an angle between that. We don't consider that U prime is, well, I guess maybe you do, that U prime is high when omega prime or W prime is low, for example. You just take an amplitude.
No, of course we do.
Okay.
Because we've got full three-dimensional linear wave functions, so they have the correct correlation between U prime and W prime.
We use the amplitude for one.
But the amplitudes, yeah, right. So you use the amplitudes then from the observations.
So the observation fixes one of the amplitudes, and the other one is just fixed by theory, as it has to be, because
okay.
These are global models.
Okay, oh, that's right. Okay, I thought you, okay. So I guess you could get that correlation in there. So, yeah, I think this would be a nice thing to do over stellar evolution times, but I think even that's going to be a bit problematic.
Because the time steps would have to be down.
Because I think you would have to resolve the oscillations in order to properly. Maybe you could resolve the oscillations over shorter time, and then average over them and say, okay, well, that will apply at this stage of evolution, and then we do it again, and then put it in again, which is kind of what you're thinking of doing, right?
Yeah.
So, so yeah, that I think, but that's going to be a little bit problem, you know, that's hard, but I think it can be done. So, so I think all of these are very complementary procedures and in trying to understand the effect of waves. Yeah.
Is it possible, you know, if you're trying to integrate over very long time scales, to kind of do like you do, I mean, with, when you do radiation transport, you don't follow the oscillations of the electric field, right? Is there a geometric optics approach or something, or maybe a Monte Carlo approach you can take to do the propagation?
I don't know.
Probably.
I mean, when you're doing heat-driven modes, you don't actually have to resolve the propagation because you've got a complete space and time description of the wave disturbances. The problem comes in figuring out how the spectrum of unstable modes and which modes are actually going to be excited to appreciable amplitudes will change over time. And that's probably the biggest barrier for doing things from the heat-driven side. I did some hokey simulations back in 2009. I have a whole ensemble of heat-driven modes. As the star develops a differential rotation profile, the excitation of those modes is changed, their growth rates change, and I allow the amplitudes to grow and decay in accordance with the linear growth rates over time. And, you know, that looked pretty, but there really was quite a lot of approximation thrown into that. So, you know, there are games you can play, but at the end of the day, when you know the full space and time dependence of the waves, you've got to really have a model for how their amplitudes will change over long time scales that are long compared to the wave propagation time but are short evolutionarily.
Well, so in the context of radiation, those would correspond to absorption and scattering coefficients.
Yeah.
So we need to work those out if one would want to try this approach.
Okay. Anyway, so. Right. So then I did these simulations. You've already seen the movie 1,000 times, or I've seen it 1,000 times. And what's cool about this, this simulation starts with zero rotation, and low rotation flows always give this result, that you get basically a retrograde flow that develops at the surface. This is angular velocity as a function of radius. The color is angular velocity, a function of time. And that retrograde flow propagates towards the source in time, kind of like a QBO. But then it's starting to reverse, and it blows up. So I can't do it. I have seen reversals in other models. It depends on how close I can go to the surface, how many density scale heights I can get in there, which is really, really, really hard to simulate. So I know, so I did this calculation in 2012 and published this in 2013, and it was for, the main application was actually hot Jupiters, so forget that. But I said, you know, the surface of the star, at least at the equator, could spin in the opposite direction, okay? And then a few years later, Connie comes up with this observation that has a star with the surface spinning in the opposite direction, okay? And apparently she had a lot of trouble getting that paper published, right? Like nobody was like, nobody believed it. No, this can't happen. You can't have the surface of a star spin in the opposite direction. There's no reason this can't happen. In fact, this isn't even a big deal, right? I think it's a big deal, but the surface layer has so little angular momentum content, you need very little to make it go in the other direction. Very little, okay? And it's...
It has little mass.
It has very little mass. Very little angular momentum. I think something like 97% of the angular momentum content of that star is in the inner 50% of the radius, or 70%. Anyway, it's a lot.
Super radiated stars?
No, it's just a 3-solar-mass star. A basic, simple, main sequence, you don't care about it star, right? 3-solar-mass star. It's a simple star. And you don't need much to spin the surface in an opposite direction. Now, this won't happen, of course, in a fast rotator, which is what most of your stars are, but it's certainly the case that it can modulate the surface differential, the surface rotation, and can cause differential rotation. So this shouldn't be that surprising. And so, you know, given what we know about what waves do and how they transport angular momentum, now the question, of course, is, yeah. This is just lines through.
The one which is
this one. Right. Yeah, this is just lines through that plot.
Yeah,
okay,
but if you start with zero angular momentum, how you can create total angular momentum? I mean, it's all negative.
No, these are just different lines. So if you integrate over the whole thing, then.
If you had started with zero, something should be positive.
Yes, the convection zone is positive, right? So this is spinning up, and the convection zone is spinning down. These are only in the radiation zone, these lines. So it's very easy. You just spin the convection up a little bit, and you can spin the surface down a lot. Yeah? That's why this is red. This is a convection zone. It's mostly red. So it's spinning up a little bit faster, and the radiation zone is spinning down. So the angular momentum content is conserved. And the way this proceeds is also really cool if you're a fluid dynamicist, but you're not. So there's a critical layer developed. So you see it just right here, it's developing very slowly, yeah? The retrograde flow. And that's from breaking waves. And then a critical layer develops. And bang, the angular velocity drops down. So a critical layer is when the angular velocity is equal to the phase speed of the dominant wave. Okay, and then the waves can really dissipate really efficiently.
Another interesting thing about that is it means it's hard to generate shear flows that are much larger in amplitude than that wave frequency divided by m.
Yeah.
So that's, of course, it depends what that dominant wave is. Usually there are many waves, so it's
right.
Difficult. But it's hard to generate really huge amounts of shear this way. Huge being compared to the wave frequency.
Okay, so, and this was 2 years later, okay, so this wasn't like, I didn't even know Connie when I made those simulations, and then she had this star that has this retrograde rotating surface, and all the seismologists can argue all they want about how they did the data. I don't want to say anything about that because I'm not an observer, but it has been observed. This is a published paper. I trust Connie's results. And so it's very possible that this is kind of what we're seeing. This is in a star what I did in that simulation. It's also possible it's not. And though
it's a pretty slow rotator, right?
It's a very slow rotator. Like I said, I could never get the surface to spin in the opposite direction if it were a fast rotator. I could get it to spin slower than the rest, but I can't get it to spin in the opposite direction. Okay.
Of course, the theory curve is pretty suggestive there, the error bars were very large.
Yes, the error bars are very large.
Be consistent with not rotating at all.
They're not consistent with. I mean, they could be in like at some level, but mostly they're. This is
signal.
Yeah.
But the star. We see rotationally split multiplets, so there's no doubt that the star is rotating. The error bars are really come about from determining which parts of the star are rotating at what rates, not that the star is rotating.
Okay.
So maybe there should be a horizontal error bar more than a vertical.
Yeah.
And so the other thing we can do, and I would say kind of this is one of the things that maybe can give us a handle. Well, it's some diagnostic of the waves, possibly. So we can't look at B stars, although we tried, but we can't really because B stars have the heat-driven modes that dominate the spectra of the stars. But if you look at O stars, which are kind of similar, they have a convective core and a radiative envelope, and it's close enough. And they have these they have high-frequency spectra, which they couldn't. They couldn't explain before when these were published. And so we can look at those, because those don't have the heat-driven mode, so we don't have to worry about pre-whitening those out. And then we can plot the observations, which are gray, and the simulations, which are red. And, of course, we move it around. What we're really looking at is just the slope. And they match pretty well. Now, and so this is what we would say is a signature of stochastically generated waves that are breaking in the atmosphere somewhere. Okay? Now, it could be, it's very possible that this is also a signature of this sort of subsurface convection zone, but we don't know that because, well, we don't have a spectra for those. We're trying to get a spectra of those, although that's so tenuous, I would really be surprised, but it's possible. And we also don't reproduce these low frequencies. That could just be a resolution thing, I'm not sure. But it's also, it's suggestive, for sure, that we might be seeing, we might actually be seeing these waves that are generated in the core propagating in the surface.
Tammy, how can you get, I mean, frequencies of 10 cycles a day, that's pretty difficult to get for an internal gravity wave in a star, isn't it?
What frequency is that in microhertz? Well, okay, so I won't say that these aren't standing waves. These are breaking waves. So what's happening at the surface is actually you've damped all what, I don't have the figure here, but I showed it, I think, during the conference. What you have is you generate this broad spectrum of frequencies. Most of the frequencies, the lower frequencies in particular, are damped through the radiation zone, but then you start to come up to the higher levels of the star, and you start to see all these high frequencies get, or low frequencies get generated again, and it's indicative of the wave breaking process, basically. You see the small scales get generated, and then you get a whole mess of noise, right? Well, noise, it's breaking waves. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So that would be a low frequency wave, you're saying?
Well, no, I'm saying 10 cycles per day, just from the stars, that's an acoustic wave, is it not?
It's pretty close to the Brunt-Weissauer frequency, I think.
The Brunt-Weissauer frequency where?
You know, in the envelope. Yeah, it changes a bit near the surface, so we have to be careful.
I think it's a little bit high.
It is higher frequency than G-modes that are usually observed, that's for sure.
Yeah.
These aren't modes. I'm not saying that these are modes. I'm saying that these are breaking waves.
But even if
and they can do whatever
waves,
the hell they want.
They still have to obey the gravity wave dispersion relation.
No, I don't think they do.
They're
breaking, they don't.
They're nonlinear.
That's right.
Don't have to obey the dispersion.
Yes, but if inside the star you're calling these internal gravity waves, they do have to obey the dispersion.
No, I'm saying this is breaking waves. So you can call it turbulence, it's waves that have traveled through the star and are now breaking.
So you're saying that there may be a cascade from lower frequencies?
Yes. Yeah, well, they're from higher frequencies to low frequency. I mean, both.
So are your waves inside, are there waves of 10 cycles per day deep in the stellar envelope? And what do you...
Deep in the stellar envelope? You mean deeper in the radiation zone?
Yes.
That are not breaking. I have to look at 10 cycles per day, because I'm not sure what that is in microhertz, but I'd have to look. I'll say that in the bulk of the envelope, you only have like the lowest lowest degrees. So you only have the large scale waves. I can't remember exactly what the frequencies are. And then as it comes to the surface, that's when it happens.
Okay, so that's about 100 microhertz, 10 frequencies.
Yeah, so I would say they're very low. There's not a lot of, there's not a lot of energy at that frequency throughout the sort of radiation zone. There's not a lot, but I think there probably is some, yeah.
Do you see a cascade to higher frequencies?
I had the figure in my talk I gave at the conference, which basically it doesn't have it. It has it for a couple of different frequencies and wave number. So you can see, and I'll draw it. So you can see that basically you have K and you have R, and you generate all this stuff, lots of Ks, small K, large K. And then throughout the radiation zone, you only get the smallest K, the largest scale, and then bang, right out here, you start to get all this again. Okay, so you see basically the very clear indication of breaking waves. And you see it for a variety of frequencies. But the lowest frequencies are sort of gone, completely gone throughout the radiation zone. Okay, so I think I'll just...
Before you go, one quick comment. Can you go back to that slide again? So does seem now to be evidence that we heard at the conference, I forgot who gave the talk, but using these microsatellites, Bright and
that in the case of O stars, the brightness variations can be associated with bright spots. And that those are thought maybe to be a consequence of, like for instance, in Zeta Puppis. Mm-hmm. And those are thought to be consequences of the iron bump maybe having a weak dynamo that basically makes bright spots in the surface. And those are very important. You see in O stars, also in B stars, but predominantly O stars, you see modulation in their ultraviolet lines that are associated with so-called discrete absorption components. And they are variations in the stellar wind that have been that can be modeled very nicely by bright spots. So anyway, I'm just making a point that the big issue here is how much structure that we see is maybe generated by the iron bump and how much would be coming from your internal gravity waves.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah. I think we don't know that.
Right.
But I will say, yeah, that's fair. We don't know that. But it is suggestive that we're getting a similar slope, right? And whether breaking gravity waves looks different than turbulent convection in this kind of thing, that's totally unclear. It's totally unclear that you could distinguish this from any other kind of turbulence, in my mind. But, okay. I have this cool bar where I can just go to that, right? Okay, so I'll just put up the summary, which is just that it's complicated, and it's complicated, and it's complicated, and that's it. So. Anything else?
You said you might say something about mixing?
Yeah, but I didn't have time. But basically, what we can do and what I've done and actually was planning and planning to finish or at least get more headway with while I'm here is basically in our simulations we can put in tracer particles and then we can follow those tracer particles for a long time and see if we can, the first question is, do they even behave like diffusion? Does delta x squared as function of time, is that a line, right? First, does it behave like diffusion? And the answer is yes, for the most part, we can do that. And then we can basically look at diffusion profile. So that's what we did here. So this is basically that simulation I showed before, just later, and we put some particles there, and we put some particles there, and we put some particles there, and then we just say, okay, is it delta x squared as function of time? Is it, you know... Yeah, okay, it's linear. And then we say, okay, well, that's not sufficient. Let's do lots. Let's do that. And do, oops. And then measure the diffusion coefficient as a function of radius. Yeah? And we can do that. And
this is the plot where you didn't show the scale.
Yeah, exactly. This is a plot where I didn't show the scale, and I'm never going to. this is a very old model, so, you know, I don't know how much I trust this one, but I will say that we've done a lot of different models, and what we're doing right now, we've put it in post-processing, so we don't have to run the particles with the simulation so that it's much faster, but that's very difficult, and because... Doing that is actually difficult. You have to really be concerned about the time, how you're doing your time stepping, because you can get some instabilities in particle tracking, which anybody who does orbits knows. So we can do that. And then we measure diffusion coefficient as a function of radius, which you need lots. And because the diffusion coefficient actually turns out to be really low, right outside the sort of overshoot zone, you need lots and lots of particles for lots and lots of time. And then you can measure this. And this is not quite right, but this profile is very robust. We've seen it, I don't know, in every simulation we've done, we get this. And this is basically autocorrelation of the wave, right, of a wave amplitude. And that's what diffusion is, right? It's a correlation over long times of small amplitudes. And so if I went to my calculations and looked at the wave amplitude as a function of radius for what I call the dominant frequency waves, we get that profile. And so basically we're going to try and nail this down some, maybe with some amplitudes. I will say that the amplitudes are not that different from what George was saying, 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 8. So it's about 10 to the 6 sometimes here and 10 to the 8. Out here. And then actually this is not quite right because the convection zone is like 10 to the 15. Okay, so it's something like that. And then now Connie's student Mai has taken that profile and put it into a MESA calculation to see if then they can reproduce their splittings. But of course, you have to bring it down because, as Connie said, they get 100 or something like that. So what we can do is, even if we don't believe this amplitude, we can say, we don't care. We'll scale it to what the observations tell us it has to be right there, and then put the profile into MESA.
This is called no rotation case.
Yes, but even the rotating cases give the same thing.
Yeah. No, but that means that the shear doesn't work at all if you have differential rotation, and that will be very theoretical.
No, because actually, so even in George's case, right, the 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 8 is, I think 10 to the 8, maybe goes up to 10 to the 10, is with rotation. And that's centimeter squared per second. We're getting similar values. But, there are models where I can look at this as a function of rotation. But rotation in these calculations is not going to be a big deal, because what rotation does is drive Eddington sweet circulation, which is not calculated in these are 2D. Yeah? So that's out. This is just the waves, effectively, and any shear that the wave induces.
So this is going to give us a background
diffusion
mixing in what otherwise would be non-mixed regions like radio.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, in a rotating MESA model, the diffusion coefficient just from all of the rotation-induced instabilities looks kind of like that as well.
That's what George said, and I tried to get him to send me, he was going to send me a profile, but I didn't get it. So that's what he said. He said it does do this thing where it rises at the surface as well.
Yeah.
I don't know if it rises in the same way or whatever, but yeah.
So you were saying that...
I did try. I ended on time, just so you know. Okay, yeah.
For the record, yeah.
Yeah.
So in the inner convection zone, you said that the real diffusion coefficient should be much higher.
No, I'm just saying that this plot is scaled weird. So actually, this goes down to like here. So this is orders of magnitude greater than here.
Yeah, which is what I'm saying, yeah, is that on the plot, it looks like they're the comparable magnitude of the surface.
Yeah, I know.
So if there were a small surface convection region,
yeah, then it could go.
You'd get a spike.
It would go up like this. Yeah, yeah. Yes. Oh boy. This is why I didn't start with mixing.
it's not actually about this.
Okay.
It's Ben Brown's 2012 paper looked into energy conservation and various different anelastic approximations, and showed that your scheme back then did not conserve energy.
Yeah.
And I know you've done one paper showing in hot Jupiter models that's not important.
Yeah.
But have you actually seen whether all of your results on wave spectra and all of that?
Yeah, all my new models. So the when I said that we ran these models with the strong forcing, yeah, and I said, but not, we've only done that for some models. All my new models have the correction in them, and it makes no difference in terms of this nonlinear behavior.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it seems like the waves that are being generated in your simulation produce diffusion coefficients that are larger by orders of magnitude, right?
Larger than what?
Than what Connie's observing.
Well, yeah, but everybody's larger than what Connie says. Yes, that's right.
So, and I think at least, this isn't true at the surface, but kind of in the interior part, the waves are pretty linear.
Yeah.
And I think we know if you have waves of a given amplitude, how much mixing they produce, right?
Well, so here's...
If you do assume that, I'm just going to complete the thought, mm-hmm, doesn't that imply that the amplitudes that you're getting in the simulations must be way larger than what are really in stars? Because if you didn't really have waves with that amplitude, that would mean that you definitely would have really large diffusion coefficients.
No, I'm saying even in my forced ones, the values are not that different than what you currently have in rotating models. 10 to the 6, 10 to, maybe 10 to
right,
the 10.
But you're not aiming for 10 to the 6, you're aiming for 10 to the 2.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that this would scale up. I think this might scale down. But that's right. So
doesn't that mean that the wave amplitudes in real stars must be much smaller than the amplitudes that you're getting in the simulation?
Okay, so in the ones I force very hard, yes, I think the wave amplitudes could be lower, right? But what I would say is that if you still, so this is actually just a simple little plot of, like, so say, assume we have that the wave amplitude when it's frequency to the minus one at generation, and if this is a three solar mass star, so frequency to the minus, and these are various different frequencies, and then we took the actual kappa from the star, right? We just said those are the amplitudes, and I'm starting with some, the, you know, the maximum is like 10 to the 5. Okay, we could scale that down. It doesn't matter. And then looked at the actual kappa. These ones drop off, but these frequencies, which are just like 5 microhertz, they make it to the surface. And if you took the autocorrelation of that, you get a diffusion coefficient like the one I showed. Yeah?
Which is way too large.
No, I don't think it is.
To the astroseismology.
Well, okay, yes, it's way too large compared to the astroseismology. I agree.
That means that the amplitude must be scaled down.
Yes, this amplitude could be, yes, it could be scaled down, but I'm not, okay, I didn't, this is still a work in progress, but yes, that's why I don't want to show amplitudes, right? That's why that plot didn't have amplitudes, is because I don't know how to scale that. I don't know how to scale that for the simulations to the star. But I actually do know how to scale it. I'm just going to give it to Connie and say, Connie, we know what the value is. Where is that plot? We know what the value is here. She knows it. And then I know that this goes up by about 2 orders of magnitude, 2 to 3, depending on various things. Let's put that in a basic calculation and see what comes out, right? That's what we're going to do. But yeah, I don't know about this.
If you do that, then you get a wave amplitude out, right? You could like back out what wave amplitude you need to get that value of the diffusivity.
It's possible.
And I think that might
possible.
Be a constraint.
Yeah, that's possible.
On the waves that
yeah.
we should expect to get from convection.
That's possible. Yeah.
So another thing about that process is, you know, Connie really only measures the diffusion at one point.
In time and space.
Small radius.
Yeah. In time and space.
So if you scale your diffusion coefficient down to match that, then of course you're going to reproduce her observations.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We're trying to reproduce our observations, but what we can do is that the uptick out here could give us very different kind of abundances we might expect.
That would be interesting.
So that's, you know, we can use other than the astroseismology. We can see what does this thing do to an evolving star compared to what we would normally do. Let's forget all those D's. Let's just put this in and basically pin it to what we have from observationally, and then go from there. I mean, again, I didn't even start talking about this. but yeah, this is where we're trying to go with this project. Yeah. Nice, York. Anyway. Yes.
I have another question not related to this.
Oh, good.
you have described the angular momentum transport from the core to the surface, but can you go the other way around?
Yeah.
Clean up the surface?
No, okay, so this is the problem, and I started with solar calculation. If people don't know me, I started working on the sun, right? And my whole PhD was on looking at convectively driven waves in the sun. And with this, you know, beautiful idea of maybe there's a QBO in the sun, and maybe the waves can, you know, change the angular momentum in the interior. And it turns out that I don't think this is very important because, well, it could be, okay, it could be. But the reason I switched to the other project is because you can get some wave amplification here due to geometry, and then the waves break. But this is moving into an increasing density profile, right? So waves are generated here, they're moving into increasing density. That means their amplitudes go down.
Tail wagging the dog.
Even if you forget the radiation, the radiative diffusion, right? So like this is a problem altogether, right? That just means the waves don't have very much dynamical effect. But if you had, I don't know, maybe if you had a big convection zone and not so much radiation zone for them to propagate through, certainly they could do something. And that's what Jim kind of works on when he looks at just like how much angular momentum content is there and how far can it propagate in the most optimal sort of case.
I think in the sun, they can definitely affect the angular momentum of the core of the sun. They can affect the spin rate potentially. But they're not going to, their amplitudes aren't going to grow such that they break and produce all this mixing.
Like, not in the same way as the other ones, yeah, because of this density thing. They can do something, but I would argue that in the sun they don't, because if the waves were to do something in the terms of the angular momentum of the sun, it would cause shear layers. It would cause shear in radiation. I actually do see that in the simulations.
Right.
It's very weak shear, but it's sufficient that we would observe it, and we don't observe it in the sun. So this is one of the arguments as to why we think that the sun has a magnetic field in there. But that's
right.
Still under debate.
That's what we haven't talked about.
That's still under debate.
Fields affect
yeah.
all of it.
surface.
That's right. And actually, I had you know, extra things about that, because that's also something I studied a lot, was how they interact with magnetic field. But obviously, there's no time for that. So anyway, right, magnetic fields affect things. But yes, you could have the reverse, but it's not as optimal for angular momentum transport just because of the density profiles. Okay?
We'll talk about that later.
We can talk offline. Yes?
In your simulation with lots of particles, you get these oscillations of the surface. Do
yeah.
you see that in observations? Or
No. No. In fact, I think that movie is a bad movie, because I think that was with the time stepping that was not very stable. So I just show it because it's nice in some ways, but I think the time stepping in this particular case was not stable, and so that could have caused some of that. Yeah, so no. And that we fixed all that, but this is the nicest movie I have of particles.
But you would expect that waves could change the rotation rate of the surface over
yes.
some characteristic
yes.
time scale.
Yes,
right?
That's right. So you're saying this small, this shorter
yeah.
time scale thing. That's right. But I do, like I said, you know, you've seen in the simulations that you do get the rotation, the whole rotation changing.
Yes.
But you're talking about these, yeah, these kind of, yeah.
Right at the photosphere, do you know what that time scale would be to reverse the directions?
God, no. I know. I tried to do it. I made a very, very hand-wavy argument as to it being a thousand, 10,000 rotation periods. But it was a very, very hand-wavy argument because, you know, these aren't 3D. We don't know how the higher latitudes are going to affect this happening at the equator. The forcing is, God knows, off. You know, but I did make some estimate that was like 10,000 rotation periods or something. I think that's long enough. Am I right? Okay, good.